coronavirus raged across the state, a weakened public health system in Florida was not able to respond. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the gutting and muzzling of public health in Florida, how it fueled the COVID fire, the latest on a new investigation. Give us a call. It's 549-2937 to join the show. Then later, that federal moratorium on evictions is about to end. We'll tell you about a new online tool for tenants who are fighting being kicked out of their homes in this pandemic. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Florida reported an increase of 183 COVID-19 deaths Tuesday. That includes 11 deaths here in Northeast Florida. At the same time, the statewide positivity rate in test results received Monday was the highest in more than a week. The Florida Department of Health's report increased the statewide death toll to 10,717. Speaking of the Department of Health, the ongoing public health crisis in this state has brought home to all of us just how critical a strong public health system is. But a new investigation shows Florida has consistently cut its public health budget over several decades. And the pandemic is spotlighting in stark terms that there has been a real cost in human lives to these budget decisions. Jason Dearen is a reporter with the Associated Press. He and several other reporters have just published a new investigation into Florida's public health seriousness and budget cuts, and he is on the line now. Hi, Jason. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your comments and thoughts about cuts to Florida's public health budget and how that has affected the death toll in this state in the coronavirus pandemic? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. This is a deep dive that the AP published, Jason, along with Kaiser Health News, and I really encourage everyone to read it online. Now, you focused on the state as a whole, but in particular, Duval County, Jacksonville. Why did you choose Jacksonville for the initial focus into this problem?
Thanks. That's a great question. So with Jacksonville, you see a lot of times the data drove us there. We were seeing, you know, the case counts rising there as well as in other population centers in Florida, like Miami. But there had been a lot of coverage, a lot more coverage of what was going on in South Florida and less kind of journalistic sunlight on what was happening in Jacksonville and Duval County. So given that it was I think the third largest rise per capita in cases over the time that we were looking at the data, we decided that it would be a good place to ground the story.
Yeah. You begin by profiling a doctor who has a practice on Jacksonville's north side, and they are absolutely slammed dealing with COVID cases. They said it sort of started like a little trickle, but now it's a steady gush from a faucet was sort of the analogy you drew, yes?
Yeah, it's an analysis the doctor drew. I spent a morning with him at his practice, Dr. Rogers Kane, and he was getting calls all morning from his patient that he serves on Jacksonville's north side who were testing positive. And he allowed me to sit in with the permission of some of his patients on some of his telemedicine consultations with these folks. And so I was able to kind of hear from and see what the effect on this one doctor's practice were. Now, we had tried also to embed with the county health department folks, but the state or the county communications folks never got back to us and never allowed that to happen. So we ended up going to a private practice, and Dr. Kane was nice enough to let me spend time with him. And then it turned out that one of his patients happened to be a retired public health nurse in Duval County who had been stricken with COVID-19, and she was amenable to being interviewed. And so that kind of served as a perfect example for the story that we're doing.
We're talking about the pandemic in Florida this morning with Jason Dearen of the Associated Press and how cuts to public health have made it worse here in Florida. We'll go to your calls in a moment. It's 549-2937 to join us. Now, public health budgets around the country have been starved. And of course, their whole function is to protect communities against disease. But your investigation at the AP, along with Kaiser Health News, found that staffing and funding fell even faster and further in the Sunshine State. Even though the population in Florida has grown by nearly 2.5 million over the last decade, the state at the same time slashed local health department staffing and budgets. About 41% less is being spent per resident than used to be spent. Cuts in Duval County, where you focused, are especially acute. And let's explain what this means, Jason. As your reporting shows, it means fewer investigators to track and trace disease. Before the pandemic, they would do that with diseases like hepatitis or sexually transmitted diseases. Fewer nurses to educate people how to protect themselves from the flu or HIV or now COVID-19. And just less of a wall of defense against disease. In Duval County, you find that they spent $91 per person on public health in 2008. In 2019, that budget was cut to $34 per resident. That is less than the typical price of a single COVID test. Former County Health Director Dr. Jeff Goldhagen said that the county health department team in Duval has essentially been dismantled, that it cannot manage an outbreak. And as you found, as reporters across the state have already known, county health departments are no longer speaking or are no longer allowed to speak about this pandemic. They don't return phone calls. They don't provide information. Everything is being funneled through the state COVID dashboard and the state spokesperson for the Florida Department of Health. And there have been questions about the accuracy of that data, too. And so, not only is the budget being cut, but county health departments have been muzzled. How did your investigation find that that muzzling impacted the ability of counties to get guidance on managing this pandemic?
Great question. Thanks. I think what we're seeing here is, these county health departments and state health departments and the CDC, public health in general, the system in place that we have in the United States, in Florida and in Duval County, is a system that's meant to respond and defend against disease outbreaks, and that's what it was built for. And so this dismantling is taking these defenses and weakening them to a point to where, when COVID-19 hit and struck with such ferocity, they just weren't able to do it. And for one example in Duval County was, about 22 workers or 5% of the staff were dedicated to preparing for and tracking disease outbreaks. And that is, with a population the size of Jacksonville, just woefully inadequate to be able to contact trace for the number of cases that are, mushrooming out of control over the last weeks. And so that's, again, why Duval was such a good example for the larger story about defunding of public health in the state. And another important aspect of public health in the training that they give epidemiologists is to have a singular voice who is communicating with the public during an outbreak or a pandemic like we're in now about safety. And what's happened here is that it's been a kind of a mishmash of messages throughout the state of Florida. So you have, St. John's County with no mask mandate, Jacksonville with no mask mandate until, I guess it was like late June, right, when Duval passed the mask mandate. And so you have these, because folks aren't able to speak and the state isn't saying much except for, what it publishes on its website, you just have a vacuum of information for people, and it's exactly what the training manuals for epidemiologists warn against.
Right. There hasn't been clear, consistent messaging. Some parts of the state are messed up, others are not. There's no mask mandate for Florida. In Duval County, you report that they have given up completely on contact tracing. you know, trying to curb the virus by identifying and warning people who've been exposed. The caseload, as we've been reporting, continues to rise. In Duval, Black residents are twice as likely to be hospitalized as white residents with COVID-19. And here's the other big revelation that we've been learning about in recent weeks. Public health workers have been silenced. They in the past would have advised local school boards about whether they should open or close schools, but they were told by the state to say nothing, to not provide guidance, essentially leaving school superintendents and school boards and educators in the dark as the school year began. That has impacted families that might not have been touched by COVID intimately, but that has affected families across this state. What have you learned about this aspect of your investigation?
Well, the you know, one of the main things we see in Florida is it's a microcosm of what's happening in the entire United States, right? And so there is a racial disparity in the amount of cases and deaths throughout the United States, and that is seen in Duval County and throughout Florida as well. Another thing that we noticed in the data was that there's a disparity in Florida among big versus small counties in the spending on public health. So it has dropped in all counties, of course, to $29 per person in 2019 on average. But in counties with 50,000 or fewer people, it's $90 per person. And there is a stark difference between larger counties like Duval and in South Florida and more rural counties. Those are, you know, there's a difference usually in political makeup there and racial makeup. And we weren't really, experts weren't really able to say exactly why that gap is wider in Florida, which has, you know, the state runs the system, but wouldn't talk to us. And there was nobody who could, who tracks this stuff, who could give us a good explanation for why that is. So the system has been defunded over decades, starting with the Bush administration and all the way. And then under Rick Scott, it fell even more precipitously. And so, but it does seem that there is still more spending in smaller, more rural counties than there is in larger counties. And, you know, again, experts don't know why that is, but it is something that we noticed and I think which needs a longer look.
Needs more of a look. As we speak with Jason Dearen of the Associated Press about the AP and Kaiser Health's investigation into the gutting of public health in Florida, what are your questions? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Mark is in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I was just curious about when your guest was doing his research, the data that I've seen, it doesn't seem that there's a consistency across states as far as who is considered a first-time COVID case. For example, in Florida, I think if you test positive for the antibodies, technically you could say, yes, that individual had COVID at some point, so they end up lumping them into the first-time positive responders. Likewise, some states report the number of patients who have recovered from COVID, and they kind of remove that from the rolls as far as how many active cases are out there. And Florida, I know, does not do that. And so I just kind of wondered, you know, every state may have its own little nuances on how they report, but as far as overall research goes, do you have to factor, I would think you have to factor that in to make drawing any kind of conclusion that there isn't consistent reporting guidelines as far as who has COVID, who's had it, how many active cases and all that. Does that play a part in your reporting or research?
Right. Thank you so much for that, Mark. Jason, it has been difficult to get a bead on the numbers. What are your thoughts about Mark's observation?
Yeah, it's a great observation, and it speaks to the importance of centralizing data and messaging during an outbreak like this. What we've seen from the get-go in the United States is a move to give states and, the kind of the leading role in response rather than in previous outbreaks, the CDC. And the CDC case definition and it would be the one that everyone adopts. And so I think that's what we've seen different states adopting different criteria for reporting and for what is even a case. And so that is bred confusion. It's bred mistrust of the data overall. And that's continuing to be a problem that's not something that's changed. And so it's a great observation.
And the distrust of the data is a big problem, because if you believe that the data is wrong, if you believe that this is all a hoax or not that big a deal, you're less likely to wear a mask. You're less likely to be cautious. You're more likely to be spreading the disease. It further fuels the disease if we can't all trust and have confidence that we're getting good, accurate data, Jason.
Right. And, gathering data on outbreaks is always a tricky affair. I mean, it's a live situation, right? And things are changing by the day, by the hour in some cases during any disease outbreak. But that's why it's even more crucial, public health experts say, that there is a centralized and organized and cohesive set of guidance and rules from the very top at CDC, and that everybody, and that there's a national strategy and not a piecemeal strategy, which is what we're seeing now, a state-by-state strategy, because in that situation, the weakest link, a state like Florida in this example, or Alabama or others that have high case counts, the United States, the country, will only be as strong as its weakest link in that kind of situation. And that's what we've been seeing play out so far.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Jane is in Pontevedra. Hi, Jane. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I have a question. Is the suppression of speech by the Department of Health about our Florida data a violation of the First Amendment?
Right. Let's talk about that a little bit, Jason. The state effectively muzzling county health departments. They are state employees, so under the law, the state can tell them not to talk to the media, so they're not breaking the law, per se. That said, it is hobbling the ability of county health departments to do their job, to minister to their local communities effectively. From what we've heard from those who used to work in public health, such as Dr. Jeff Goldhagen, he's now at UF Health Jacksonville. He used to lead the Duval County Health Department. So what about this whole dynamic we're seeing in Florida, where the state, the governor, and his leadership are not allowing county health departments to talk to reporters, to put out any data, to advise school boards and the like?
Right. It's a big problem in terms of communicating with the public. And as we've seen here, our request to do the type of reporting that we wanted to do, which was to, we have the data, we understand that the budget decisions have been made over time, and we wanted to be able to tell people what was happening inside the department at this key moment in our history with this virus, and that wasn't allowed. And so these are the types of trade-offs you get with, I think from a state management perspective, they want everything to be unified, but they're not saying much other than releasing the data. And so it's important during past outbreaks that local health departments can speak to their communities. They understand their local communities better than someone, in Tallahassee would. And they can get out there, get into the schools, get into the community and talk with folks. I mean, we're just not seeing that happen. And they usually use the press or work with the press to get that information out, whether it's the great local paper you have there, the Times Union, or someone like me with the Associated Press. They can get out and get their message to a local audience. And so, that's just not happening. And, the effects of that on the spread of disease in the community will be the subject of many studies going forward, but it certainly doesn't seem to be helping anything.
549-2937. Lots of calls. Stanley on the North Bank. Hi, Stanley. Haven't heard from you in a bit. How are you?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Okay, go ahead.
It's an honor. It's an honor to speak to you.
Well, thank you. You too.
Yes, ma'am. First of all, we have a problem that's causing the increase in this pandemic. It's a leadership problem and money. And once we address those two issues, we'll be able to decrease this pathology that we have. And that's what's causing a big problem here. You have politics and money. As long as you have those two in the middle of everything, you're going to have a problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for those points. Tim in St. John's County. Hello, Tim. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I had a question regarding the informative information that we're getting this morning. You're talking about how you would like to see more information for the whole state, but I find it hard to believe that you really believe that the same thing and the same issues that are in Dade County exist in the northern part or the panhandle part of the state. And so I'm a little confused. It seems like you're suggesting that you think that everything should be the same for the whole entire state. And if you've traveled the state at all, you know that it's very diverse. So there's a lot of difference between one end of the state and the other.
All right, Tim, thanks for that. Sure. Jason, what about that?
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's true. However, the spread of the disease and the behavior of the virus is not necessarily diverse. It spreads and behaves the same way. That said, what we're also talking about is what we're reporting is that the local health departments, the county health departments, aren't allowed or have not been allowed to communicate with us in the press or the public, and you know, through press conferences or those types of things. And so that type of difference in a community in South Florida or Duval County or the Panhandle, the local health departments in those counties would have the expertise of their communities and be able to shape the message to fit those communities. And that's what we're talking about here, that kind of nimbleness to be able to speak to specific communities on the county level is not being allowed.
Right. Now, this investigation really does lay bare the issues with public health in Florida. And as we mentioned, this is a problem in all 50 states, but I think in Florida, it's been especially acute. Do you think coming out of this pandemic, there might be a revisiting of the importance of public health departments? As you report, along with Kaiser Health, they began almost 100 years ago. They were essentially designed to provide lower income patients with basic health care and treatment. In the 90s, everything moved toward a more privatization model, particularly as Medicaid managed care took hold. But that said, there is still a vital role for public health to play. So how do you think this pandemic might nudge states toward reallocating budgets in the future when they look at how public health helps build a firewall against the spread of disease?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see the shift away from, you know, traditional publicly funded public health departments has been one that's been happening over decades. It's been partly voter driven. Leaders have been elected who favored shifting resources from publicly funded departments to more privatized departments. Whether or not, you know, the lessons we're learning during this pandemic will create a new drive in voters to elect leaders who want to refund public health departments remains to be seen. I'm not a political prognosticator, but I do know that there are hard lessons being learned that our data show that defunding these departments over decades to the extent that they are now in Florida and Duval County have hampered the response in those communities. And so whether or not people want to see change, that will remain to be seen in upcoming elections.
Yeah. And since you published this piece along with Kaiser Health, have you heard from any county health employees in Florida? Have they reached out to you? Have you gotten any feedback?
Yes, there have been a number of messages that I've received. Also, people on Twitter who have said they had worked for health departments in the state during the years that the data that we're writing about, and who witnessed firsthand, the people being let go, positions remaining unfilled that were empty. Which is a big part of that kind of attrition was used by a lot of these administrations to eliminating jobs that weren't filled was a way of downsizing the departments. So yes, it's the data that we're reporting has been borne out many times by people who work in various departments around the state who have all seen and been a part of the these departments as they were shrinking.
It's really good to get you on the show, and I want to thank you for your reporting and also sharing the insights with our listeners. Thanks so much, Jason. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Melissa. I appreciate it.
He's Jason Dearen with the Associated Press, and you can check out this deep dive into Florida's public health issues with a particular focus on Duval County. It's a joint investigation by the Associated Press and Kaiser Health News. Check it out online this week. I would encourage you to do that. And much more still ahead on the show. Later, we've got some positive news for your midweek in our What's Good Wednesdays, including a local chef who won last night on the Food Network hit Chopped Sweets. We'll find out what happened with Chef Rebecca Reed. That's coming up a little later in the hour. But up next.
So if you go to FloridaEvictionHelp.org, you'll see a guided interview that will ask you a series of questions based on your eviction complaint.
Moratoriums on evictions could be ending soon. Jacksonville Area Legal Aid has put together a new online tool if you're a tenant facing eviction. We'll tell you how to access that help right after this here on First Coast Connect. Don't go away.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Actor Billy Porter lived through the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 80s, and he says the words of wisdom he learned back then could help with the times we're living through right now.
Love always wins. Mm. Love always wins. Mm. That's it.
Poe star Billy Porter on love, race, church, and an Emmy nomination. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Saturday at noon here on WJCT News 89.9.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Snap judgment means your mother, your kids, the dog, and your boss are just going to have to wait until the story is over. Mm-hmm. Join me, Glenn Washington, for Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, people struggling in this COVID pandemic are bracing for a potential wave of evictions. That's because a federal moratorium on kicking people out of their homes in this crisis that has been in effect for several months now, since March, it is soon coming to an end unless Congress acts. Local attorneys at Jacksonville Area Legal Aid are stepping up to help people in this crisis. They've developed a new online tool for tenants fighting evictions because they are unemployed due to the pandemic. I learned more from the organization's president and CEO, Jim Kowalski. Hi, Jim. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about this new online tool that Floridians facing eviction can use. How does it work?
Sure. So when somebody is served with eviction paperwork, they'll get the court paper, and it will direct them to file a response in 5 days. That's a pretty quick turnaround. And knowing that the moratorium was going to end at some point, we wanted to have something ready online for folks to use in preparing their responses in that 5 days. So if you go to FloridaEvictionHelp.org, you'll see a guided interview that will ask you a series of questions based on your eviction complaint. And through following that guided interview, you'll be able to produce the pleading that you then file in court.
And this was created by your organization, Jacksonville Area Legal Aid. Currently, there is a moratorium on evictions in Florida, but that could be rescinded pretty soon. There's a lot of worry out there, isn't there?
Right. And part of the issue is that the moratorium actually ended August 1st. So August 1st, evictions and foreclosures recommenced all across the state. What the latest order from the governor did, though, is it handed tenants and a defense that they have to make in those 5 days. And that defense is that if they can show that the reason for not paying the rent was due to a COVID-19 income loss, and they can communicate and prove that to the court can still process through the eviction, but the court is not allowed to issue that final action, which is called a writ, and that is the last thing that happens when the tenant's belongings are actually removed from their dwelling place. So evictions recommenced with this important defense added into the order, and we added that defense into our tool. So when folks go through and prepare their answer, if they can show a COVID-related income loss, they can use this tool to present that information to the judge.
Thanks for that. That clarifies it. I had had it in my mind that the tenants were protected through the rest of August. So this is helpful information. And we're talking about nearly a million people at potential risk in the state, correct?
Right. Some of the studies that we've shown put a very high number, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Floridians at risk. And knowing that we have that number, knowing that we don't have enough legal aid lawyers in the entire state to handle that volume, and knowing that most of the online tools are directed at landlords, right? There is no tool currently in place through the bar or through the court system that allows a tenant to prepare their answer. There are tools for landlords. So we wanted to have something in place thanks to some hard work by legal aid housing lawyers all over the state, and thanks to a grant that we received from the Center for Disaster Philanthropy. We wanted to be able to build this and then house it for folks to use all over the state of Florida.
What else should people know that are in this fix right now? What's the other big piece of information that maybe we're missing here that can really help people?
So they should be turning to their local county websites, their local United Way websites. In this case, in Duval County, United Way 211 is really the place that is collecting all of the different data for folks to apply for financial assistance. Those same groups are coordinating food assistance for folks. So reach out to those entities and reach out to your landlord. We've had a letter form on our website for some time now. Many of the legal aides around the state are doing the same thing. where you can reach out to your landlord and say, I've got this money, I've got this extra money potentially from, let's say, the City of Jacksonville's Emergency Assistance Program. Will you take 50 cents on the dollar? Will you take 40 cents on the dollar? Can we resolve this pre-eviction? Once the eviction is filed, though, they have to respond within those 5 days. And now is the time to be collecting the proof, right? You can show a COVID-related income loss in a lot of different ways, but that's going to be something you have to show to the judge in a written document and then prove to the judge in your hearing in order for the judge to have the ability to say, landlord, this is a person who cannot be evicted until the beginning of September. I cannot issue that writ until September because this person has complied with the governor's latest executive order, even though the eviction has restarted.
Hmm. That is so helpful. And again, the website, this new tool for tenants, is at this site. It's floridaevictionhelp.org, floridaevictionhelp.org, created by Jacksonville Area Legal Aid. If you are at risk of eviction, check out floridaevictionhelp.org. And I want to thank you, Jim. He's president and CEO of Jacksonville Area Legal Aid, Jim Kowalski. Thanks for all the work you do for this community.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Tonight is the third night of the Republican National Convention. Here's Tiffany Trump making the case for her father's reelection.
My father built a thriving economy once, and believe me, he will do it again.
Live coverage of the third day of the RNC tonight with recaps and analysis tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's the middle of the week, and this is the time on the show when we sort of take a little breath and check in on some positive news happening across this community. We've all been through a lot, and times are challenging, but there are good things happening out there, and we celebrate it in our What's Good Wednesdays. Yes, let's do it right now as we begin with our four-legged friends. Did you know that today is National Dog Day? Dogs have been bringing us comfort and joy for at least 14,000 years now. And in this time, I think our dogs are more important to us now than ever. I know that's true at our household. Now, the holiday experts at National Today, that's the internet's number one authority for holidays, they surveyed 3,000 Americans about their pets, and they found 70% of dog owners prefer to spend time with their dogs versus people. Nearly a quarter of men would prefer to spend time with their dogs than go on a date. And nearly 4 in 10 women also say that. 68% of dog owners allow their dog to sleep with them at least once a month. And here are the top 5 dog-loving states: California, New York, Washington, Tennessee, and Florida, coming in at number 5. So we got a lot of dog lovers out there. Here's what I want you guys to do. Email us a picture of your dog to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We'll include it in our What's Good Wednesdays e-blast that goes out later today. Let's see those pups that are keeping you happy in this tough time right now. Some more good news to share. The Cultural Council of Greater Jax is gearing up for its annual Arts Awards. This year, it will be a virtual affair. I got some highlights from Ellen Cottrell, their coordinator for programs and public engagement.
Well, we're really excited about this. Of course, it's going to be a virtual event like everything is right now, but it will be Wednesday evening, September 2nd at 7 o'clock. It will be streamed live on our Facebook at the Cultural Council, also on WJCT's Facebook and website, and also Downtown Vision's Facebook. We have 9 awards this year. We added one, which is a People's Choice Award. And then the rest of the evening is just, we're going to have some performances. We have an amazing performance by Philip Pan, who's a violinist. He's actually, and I haven't announced this to anybody yet, so first time on your show, he did his own compilation of Bohemian Rhapsody for the violin, and that's what he'll be doing for the evening. So we're really excited about that.
People need to click on just to watch that alone, but it's exactly. They should watch it for all of these reasons because you're celebrating the cultural community.
Exactly. And it's an exciting time to do that. It's an important time to do that because the arts are important just to even get through this. And we've seen that in all of the virtual classes and the virtual exhibits and concerts and things that people have been tuning into and everyone's been kind of pivoting with the galleries and museums and everything. And they've been so popular during this time when everyone's, you know, pretty much in their homes. And to go along with that, we knew that one of the things people would be missing from the Arts Awards is just the mingling, the part, you know, you get there and you want to see what everyone's wearing and you want to see your old friends and have a drink and catch up. So we planned a pre-awards virtual cocktail party that we're excited about, which will take care of some of that, not like we're in person, but we'll get some of that feeling during that time as well.
And that was Ellen Cottrell. Now, the 44th Annual Cultural Council Arts Awards streams live next Wednesday evening, September 2nd at 7 p.m. You can check it out on their Facebook page, Downtown Vision's Facebook page, and WJCT's Facebook page, too. Or register online at culturalcouncil.org. All right, finally, we want to serve up some hearty congratulations to Jacksonville pastry chef Rebecca Reed. Yes, Reed, who was on this show yesterday and serves up those confections at Bellwether, Orsay, and Black Sheep, was the winner of last night's episode of Chopped Sweets on the Food Network. It was a tropical food challenge. Rebecca's entry won the whole thing. So Rebecca, great job. Really exciting to see you showing out so well on national TV. We'll have more about Rebecca's sweet victory and some other positive news and notes later today in our What's Good Wednesdays e-newsletter. It's your little blast of good vibes in this challenging time. Hundreds of you have already subscribed. You can sign up for free at WJCT.org as we share some good news and also some behind-the-scenes stuff that goes on here on the show and at WJCT. Well, in a moment, this era of forgivable loans is helping people and businesses in so many ways, and that actually includes historic preservation in the city of Jax. We'll tell you how after this.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
On the next Fresh Air, as President Trump prepares to accept the Republican nomination for a second term, we speak with historian Rick Perlstein. He spent his career studying the rise of the new right in American politics. He's just published his fourth book about American conservatism, focusing on the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. It's called Reaganland. Join us.
Today at noon, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Having a bank in a community means members of that community are
more likely to be able to get a
business loan or a mortgage loan and to have a place to go to when your tires are out to get a small dollar loan.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Access to banking. Who has it, who doesn't, and what that does to the local economy. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 here on WJCT News 89.9.
It's been almost half a year since police shot and killed Breonna Taylor in her Louisville home. Despite months of protest, no officers have been charged. Now officers in Kenosha have shot Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old black man, multiple times in the back. What has and hasn't changed since America's summer of racial reckoning? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Jacksonville Historical Society is coming out in support of a new program to revitalize historic landmarks in the city. Now, this includes forgivable loans and adaptive reuse plans for older buildings in Jacksonville's urban core. With more about this, I spoke with the Society President and CEO, Alan Bliss.
Hi, Alan. Good to be with you. Thanks for joining the show.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks a lot for having me.
So tell me a little bit about this effort that the Historical Society is joining to revise historic preservation and revitalization guidelines for the city.
Sure. Melissa, historic preservation is part of our advocacy mission. And you may know, and many people do, that each year the Historical Society publishes a list of Jacksonville's most endangered buildings. We do that to call attention to the increasing obsolescence and the loss of historic structures. And this has become a hot topic over the last year or so. There has been an increase in the tempo of demolitions of buildings, and we regret seeing that. We understand that not every building can be saved, but there are buildings that are useful at interpreting this city's history and telling its stories. Probably one of the highest profile was Old Fire Station No. 5 over on Riverside Avenue, which was demolished last year. That attracted a lot of attention and really elevated the subject of demolitions and historic preservation into the conversation. There have been some great saves and some great rescues of buildings that have really contributed a lot to telling Jacksonville's story through its built environment. Probably some of the most obvious are the old Jacksonville Main Public Library, which is now the Jesse Ball DuPont Center, a magnificent restoration of a building that sat idle for years that faced lots of challenges to reuse it. The Calford Chop House is a high-profile example. Probably one of the most recent is the Barnett Bank Building, which is now the Barnett Apartments, a great save right in the core of downtown. The old Brewster Hospital over on West Monroe, which is now the headquarters of the North Florida Land Trust. So we argue that historic preservation of old buildings is not just sort of this touchy-feely thing that people appreciate being able to see an old building, but it adds to the authentic experience of a neighborhood, and it is economic development in its own right. A historic preservation of an old building costs a lot, and it's a highly specialized project. You have to really want to save an old building badly to start down that road.
Yeah.
Old buildings have lots of surprises, and they're not very often pleasant surprises.
Yeah, right. That is for sure. And so, some buildings have fallen to the wrecking ball, which has really been bad news for people that tried to save them, as you said. And so you're getting behind the Downtown Investment Authority's package of incentives, right, to keep some of these buildings intact.
Yes. I should say that historic preservation is not just about downtown Jacksonville, but we do have a National Register Historic District in downtown Jacksonville now. We have a lot of older buildings, and some of them have been under threat in recent years. Probably one of the most controversial in recent months was the proposed demolition of the old First Baptist Church Sunday School building. The permission was granted for that. That project has been put in abeyance. Another building that's under threat is the old Doro Manufacturing Building over here on the east side of Jacksonville on A. Philip Randolph Boulevard. So the Downtown Investment Authority is concerned about trying to help developers who face these challenges And for many years, they had a very valuable asset in their toolbox. That was the Historic Preservation Trust Fund, which was funded by the city council back in the early 2000s with, I think, about $12 million. Council did not refund that that fund. It has gradually had a dwindling balance as projects have come before it and been approved and supported over the years. And the trust fund actually was not a very flexible tool. So what the DIA has come up with now is a package of incentives that include small grants, grants to help fund restoration and renovation, and grants that can help bring buildings into compliance with the modern building codes. All of those things are different problems. And I think that what Lori Boyer, the executive director of the DIA, is trying to accomplish with this is to give her and her team some flexibility, and the governing board of the DIA, some flexibility to be supportive to developers and to help bridge that last mile or so that it takes in order to have a project of historic renovation make economic sense. The point is, historic preservation actually yields long-term value and benefits
sure.
to the community.
Look at the tourism in Savannah and Charleston is another obvious example right here in the Southeast. And
yes.
So, Alan Bliss, it's always great to get your insights. I'd encourage people to check out the Historical Society's website online, too, at jackshistory.org for more. Alan Bliss is CEO of the Jacksonville Historical Society. Thank you so much.
Thanks to you, Melissa. Have a great day.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. You can also catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, or our podcast will be up later today. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Have a great Wednesday, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.